Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cowboy Chemistry, where we talk about the wilder days of chemistry. My name is Dylan Gardner. My pronouns are they, them, and I'm a PhD candidate here at Texas Tech in chemistry. My guest today is Tori Bybee. She is a high school English teacher, a locum comedian, and friend of mine. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. Got the Mondays a little bit, but it's nice to have something to look forward to at the end of the Monday, so I'm excited to be here. This
Great.
Made the Monday easier to get through.
Yeah, I think everyone on a Monday feels dead and tired and just does not want to be wherever they are.
Whether
it's work or schools.
Yes. Amen.
So, I ask every guest this, so how much chemistry do you know?
The amount of chemistry that I know is laughable. I had science in high school and I was a hooligan. So, let's preface with that. So, even if I had a brilliant science teacher, I wouldn't have paid attention to the brilliant science teacher. And I had, write down the vocabulary. And then I came to Texas Tech University, where I took non-major chemistry. Cried the first day of class, immediately dropped it, and then, because they started with this sentence, we're gonna review what you should know from high school, and then we'll start building on it, and I realized quickly I didn't know anything from high school, and so I took atmospheric science and horticulture, were the two science credits that I got here at Texas Tech University.
Horticulture, trees, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was half plant biology and half landscape architecture. Which was half science and what I needed.
Yeah. I actually really love teaching non-majors when I get the chance, but I really try to not put that sentence of, let's review what you should know from high school or whatever. And I'm no, most people, that makes them panic.
No, I panicked. So I'm talking real genuine tears because I was I don't know what any of these words mean that you're using. And I've heard them maybe in context, twice. So I was I know it was, everybody else was pretty okay, or at least they were doing a better job acting than I was, because I was looking around just in panic and disarray. I was I went to my advisor and was I'm gonna fail, and I know that on day one, so let's make a new choice for me. She did. She was yes ma'am, let's go.
Yeah, I mean, day one's the day to figure it out, honestly. If you're gonna switch, do it quickly. When I started my college career, it was first in chemical engineering, and I took my first semester classes, which were not actually any engineering, and then the second semester I got into my first engineering class. The first the first lecture is always syllabus. The second lecture I was this is awful, I'm leaving. So
what a disheartening moment.
Yeah. It really sucks, but if you feel that way, drop the class, leave.
We gotta go.
It's okay.
Something else is waiting for you.
Yes. Yeah, today, of course, we're talking about radiocarbon dating. What do you know about radiocarbon dating?
I feel when I hear that, my brain goes dinosaurs. Is that even remotely right?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay, good. I was really panicked. I was oh no, I'm dumb. And I'm so smart, but I was oh no. But that's how we date anything. How long has passed when we find a thing, and that's how we figure out how old the thing is.
It is one of the ways to
one
do
of
that,
the ways.
Yes.
Okay.
That's not the way a lot of, there are, this is the very sciencey way, I guess, which, I mean, the geology way is also sciencey, but you can also tell by the layers of dirt, and that's, so a lot of stuff is dated that way, and then radiocarbon dating is very specific to organic material.
So would be living creatures or lived
yes.
at one time. Okay.
Yes. So something that was once alive, you can radiocarbon date.
Cool. Got it.
So you can't really radiocarbon date things like pottery or arrowheads. So if you're trying to do that, you wouldn't be able to.
Right. So 50% of the stuff at Pompeii, you could radiocarbon date people, but not stuff.
Right.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Pompeii might not work because of
other factors that we'll get into.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, because like it'll get basically you get contamination. But yeah, to get back into like the science of it first, so radiocarbon dating is like a method for determining the age of an item that was a formerly living material by using the properties of carbon-14. So carbon-14, like the first word is obviously the element, and then 14 is its isotope, right? So carbon-14 is radioactive. Most carbon that we have in the world is carbon-12. That's the most common isotope. And so essentially that number is the sum of the particles in the nucleus, mm-hmm. right? So you have, carbon is 6 on the periodic table, right? So it has 6 protons. And so carbon-12 would have 6 protons plus 6 neutrons. So that's the total of both of those particles. So when we're talking about carbon-14, it's 6 protons and 8 neutrons, right? Yeah.
That's smart math.
And then there's also a small amount of carbon-13, and carbon-14 is even smaller than that. So, if it's like, I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are, but it's like 99% carbon-12. And then 1% is split between carbon-13 and 14.
Oh, wow.
So very small.
Right.
A very small amount. So carbon-14 is also called radiocarbon. So those will be like used interchangeably throughout this podcast. So if I say radiocarbon, I'm talking about carbon-14.
Got it.
So radiocarbon is actually formed in the atmosphere. Way up in the upper atmosphere, the atmosphere is getting attacked. Attacked is probably not the right word, but... bombarded, whatever word you want to use,
like both of those.
Galactic cosmic rays. Galactic cosmic rays are not coming from the sun. So, like, they're if you have to say solar rays, that's coming from the sun. Galactic rays are coming from...
like, the universe at large?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, further out past the sun. I did not get a clear answer on, is this other stars? Is this just, like, background radiation of the universe? I wasn't quite clear on what exactly it is, but it's not the sun that is giving off this radiation.
Okay.
Yeah, and so what happens is the galactic cosmic rays, when interacting with the atmosphere, create a neutron, and then that neutron will hit an atom of nitrogen-14, and then nitrogen-14 will absorb that neutron into its nucleus, and then it will emit a proton. So it took in a neutron, spit out a proton, and now it is carbon-14.
Okay.
Right?
That makes sense. I like that the spit out thing makes sense in my brain.
Yeah.
Got it. I like the visuals. I need the visuals.
Yeah. The half-life of that isotope of carbon-14 is 5,730 years plus or minus 40 years. So we can tell the age of something plus or minus about 40 years. And that does depend on exactly what the sample is and how old it is. But, like, generally, we know the date, how long radiocarbon's half-life is.
Oh, okay.
By 40 years.
That makes sense.
And so once it's created, the new carbon atom will react with oxygen in the atmosphere to create carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide then gets absorbed into plants, and then it goes through the carbon cycle. So, like, there's a water cycle, there's also a carbon cycle.
Noted.
Right.
I missed all of this. Wow. Okay.
I don't think they talk about the carbon cycle very much. So I don't think it's, like, I feel like a lot of people know about the water cycle, but nobody talks about the carbon cycle.
Right. I'm like, okay, I got, like, third grade science water cycle. But then I was like, I've never heard these words put together. Ever. But then I was like, oh. Maybe it's just me.
Okay. So maybe another way to think of it is like the food chain.
Okay.
Right?
That makes
sense. So, plants take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
Right.
They're making their own food with sunlight and water. And then bigger animals will eat the plants. And then those animals get eaten by other animals.
That makes sense.
That carbon dioxide starts in the plant and then gets disseminated through the animal life.
Right. So it's never gone. It just goes through all the different things.
Right.
Okay, cool. Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the CO2... that contains the carbon-14 first diffuses through the atmosphere, and then it will dissolve into the oceans, where plants will use the CO2 and deposit that carbon-14 into their cells, right? Animals eat the plants, and carbon-14 gets incorporated into their cells, and once the animal or plant dies, it stops absorbing carbon-14.
Okay, and that's how you can figure out the age. So it's like you can carbon date something according to its death?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So we can know when it has stopped absorbing carbon-14 because the level of carbon-14 will decrease over time because it's radioactive.
Right.
I don't know why that's a thing.
That makes sense. So then you have to, like, kind of have an idea of how long creatures were living at the time, then to kind of make, does that something you need to, like, make an estimation, or?
Not really, because it doesn't really matter how long they lived, necessarily,
right.
Because that's still going to be, like, a blink of an eye to the
right,
half-life
to, like,
of carbon-14.
How long is the universe? Right.
So, because, like, most animals, like, I can think of, like, the longest-lived animal probably lives, like, 150 years.
Right.
You know, trees can live longer than that,
right.
But especially animals, I would think that it would not be super matter how long that particular animal lived.
Right. We have this idea that, like, we're kind of self-absorbed with our own lifetimes, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, we've been here for 5 minutes.
It kind of looks like that sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think one of the cool things about carbon-14, and we'll get to this later, is to put into context how long people have been places, how long animals have been places.
Right.
Because, and I'll get to this a little later in the podcast, of, like, we have basically confirmed that humans have been in the Americas for longer, a lot longer than we thought.
Really?
A lot longer.
Huh. That's cool.
Yeah. So, like, you know, the whole, the story you probably, most people have heard is the land bridge brings people over.
Right.
And, like, that probably did happen. I'm not saying that humans did not come across that land bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But let me say that is not the first time humans got into the Americas.
That, like, broke my brain. That's crazy. Because I've never heard anything else. Like, and that's kind of almost pretty widely accepted that, like,
yeah,
well, this is where we came from and here's how we got here.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
And so it's really, yeah, and this is, like, really new. So this, really, they confirmed this last year. So, like,
wow.
don't be like,
that's
oh, I
should have
known this. It's very brand new.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I like how, like, science kind of changes, though, because, like, that's a brand new piece of information that
mm-hmm.
throws everything, like, we've known on its head, everything our parents and grandparents have known on. That's amazing.
Yeah, and there
that's
have
cool.
been people who have said this before, but the evidence was weaker. So this is, like, the first evidence that people have had that you can't really argue with.
Wow.
So.
That's fascinating. Like, that blew my mind. I've never even thought about a different possibility. But, I mean, like, that's cool that made it. I like being wrong. That's fun.
Yeah, it's really been an interesting thing to learn, because, and, like, to learn that there was actually this whole debate beforehand of, like, when people got to the Americas.
So. I mean, that throws off, like, that's several lifetimes worth of work for people, and just, like, finding, like, that key piece of evidence that, like, totally shifts it into a new direction. It's kind of like
yeah.
a soccer ball, like, and now we go over here and we go this direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But to get back into the, like, invention of carbon dating, the concept of radiocarbon dating can be tracked back to the work of Sergei Korff, a physicist that discovered that neutron bombardment of the gases in our atmosphere created neutrons. So what I was talking about, he was the one who figured out that, and this is just a prediction, so he didn't actually measure this, but it was a prediction based on physics that neutron would transform the nitrogen-14 into carbon-14. And then later that same year, they officially discovered carbon-14, and that was Martin Kamen and Samuel Rubin of the Radiation Laboratory at Berkeley. So they synthesized carbon-14 using the laboratory's cyclotron accelerator, which it's like a particle accelerator. Like, you know, you make things go really fast.
It feels like science fiction to me. I'm like, that's something they have at NASA. And then I'm like, I have no other context for that at all. And I don't think they have that at NASA. I just
no.
am thinking about the thing they put the people in, but it's too fast for the people.
Yeah.
Man, this is really
so, like, CERN?
Yeah.
That, it's
oh.
kind of, CERN is a really, really big one.
Yeah.
But, like,
I've heard of this.
A similar idea of, like, you
right.
have things going pretty fast and they're colliding into each other. That's a very low-level description
Thank
of
you.
What a cyclotron
I appreciate
is. But,
the low.
but when they synthesized it, they actually discovered that the atom's half-life was longer than they previously thought. By calculation, by their calculation with measurement, it was 5,568 years, which compares to our modern, better measurement, you know, because they have a little bit less equipment back
mm-hmm.
then. So the modern number is 5,730, right? So they were pretty close.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty long half-life. And then at some time during World War II, Willard Libby, who was also at that Berkeley lab, learned of Korff's research and conceived of the idea that it might be possible to use radiocarbon for dating. There's a theoretical discovery, there's the actual discovery, and then this guy was like, this is a cool application we could use it for.
Oh, cool, okay.
So.
I need a pause. I need you to explain, like I'm dumb, a half-life.
Oh, okay, yes.
I was like, wait a second.
Sorry, I am a radiochemist, so some of these terms sometimes I get taken for granted,
oh, yeah.
Like that other people don't know.
Well, the only place I've ever heard this is like in medicine. Like,
yes.
The half-life of medicine. So then I'm like, mm-hmm. I kind of have an idea of what it means, but I want to make sure I'm right so I understand the rest of this.
Yeah, so half-life is essentially the amount of time it takes for a sample to decrease by half.
Okay.
So if I had like 10 atoms of carbon-14, it would take 5,000 years for it to degrade your...
To where there would be five. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
So, like, the half-life of ADHD medication is, like, 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Okay, I understand.
So that, in the case of medicine, is how long it takes for half of that medicine to leave your body.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, I have a context now.
Yes.
Ready to go.
And so in 1945, Willard Libby, the one who was like, I could use this for radiocarbon dating, he moved to the University of Chicago, where he began his work trying to figure out how to do that. He's like, I have this idea, now how do I do it? He published a paper in 1946, about a year later, in which he proposed that the carbon in living matter might include carbon-14. So this is just him publishing the idea. He still hasn't really proven anything. And then the first issue that he had to solve was that, like, we artificially made carbon-14, but we have not actually measured it in any regular material yet.
Oh, big problem.
Yeah, so they're like, I think carbon-14 should be in living matter. Well, no one's actually detected it in living matter before.
Right. Big problem.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can't experiment on... live subjects then? Is that...
So the issue was that basically the amount of carbon-14 is very, very low.
Mm.
So, and this is 1945.
Right.
Right? And so their technology is just not at the same level.
Not able to detect it yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. By Korff's estimation, the one who did the original theoretical calculations, it was just 2 neutrons were produced per square centimeter of Earth's surface. So essentially, the ratio of one carbon-14 atom to just carbon atoms on Earth, one carbon-14 to every 10 to the 12th, so that is one with 13 zeros behind it, carbon atoms. So it's very small amount.
That's wild.
And again, 1945, you need a really concentrated sample to start detecting things that you have never detected before.
Right.
Yeah, and so the sample size is just super tiny. And so what Libby and several collaborators proceeded to experiment with was methane, collected from sewage in Baltimore.
Huh. I love that. Scientists are resourceful.
Yeah. It had to be nasty. When I read this story, I was like, why did you pick this?
That's commitment.
Like, yeah.
No one can say they didn't want to figure it out because they're wading in sewage.
Yeah. So the methane was enriched with carbon-14 compared to other samples. So because I think it was just the amount of methane they had,
right.
Because it's a gas, you could compress it into a pretty small space. And like, so you had, and it, methane is basically entirely carbon and hydrogen.
Right.
Or it, I shouldn't say basically, it is. There's a couple like other things in there. No, there's not.
Got it. Yeah.
But yeah, it's all carbon hydrogen, so like if you just can pack a bunch of it into one space,
right.
I think that's kind of what their idea was. And with this enriched methane, they were able to demonstrate that the methane absolutely contained carbon-14.
Oh. That's cool.
Yeah, because if you have a pure sample of carbon, right?
Right.
And you are detecting radiation, it's gotta be carbon-14. Because it would either be carbon or hydrogen.
Right.
So, like...
So, it's one of... Yeah. That makes it... It's kind of cut and dry. It's black or white.
Yeah.
That's smart.
Like...
Because they did not make extra work for themselves.
Yeah. Because, I mean, as long as you made sure you had pure methane...
Yeah.
So, like, this showed that there was the existence of naturally occurring carbon-14, but did not actually solve the problem of how to measure what is normally a much lower carbon-14 in samples.
Right.
So, it was like... again, it's a step in the right direction, but not actually the solution. And so really the key was to reduce background noise. So when I talk about background noise, that's just like the radiation that is just around all the time.
Okay.
Because, like, I don't know if people know this, but, like, solar radiation, all that. There's a lot of naturally radioactive isotopes. Potassium's a really common one.
Did not know that.
And that's a really funny thing, because, like, I work with depleted uranium in my research, right? The amount of radiation dose that I get from uranium, depleted uranium, is, you know, not any worse, for sure, than the amount that people would get from working with potassium.
That's wild.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I guess people just think, like, oh, that one's so much more, I guess, available. Or, like, I guess I'm like, I would know where to do that. Or, like, I would know where to get that. And I do not work in science at all. Like, yours sounds scary as I think what it is.
Yeah. Well, so, like, because, like, I work with depleted uranium. You can't really make weapons out of it.
Mm.
You know, like, it's not, the radiotoxicity is not very high.
Huh.
You know, like, it, as far as that goes, like, it's much more dangerous is the fact that it's a heavy metal. The fact that it's a metal is what's going to hurt me more than the radiation.
That's interesting. I bet people look like when you say that, like, that's scary. Did you get that reaction a lot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had people go like, oh, you must wear a hazmat suit at work. And I don't.
No. That's like my favorite part of your set, I think, is you just absolutely blowing people's minds about what they think scientists are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think people kind of, once you say what you do, people are like, yes, Dylan is here in a lab coat and goggles and, like, holding several beakers. And it's like, Dylan is here in overalls.
Yes, yes. I wear overalls in the lab all the time.
So much.
We do wear lab coats and everything. The thing that I think is funny, though, is, like, most chemists are like, oh, gotta wear a lab coat because it's hot and you gotta wear it the whole time.
Yeah.
It's just a little annoying. And then, like, I find especially, like, social sciences and, like, medical doctors, they are like, yes, I get to wear a lab coat. And I just think it's a funny attitude. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with them wearing lab coats. Like, some people really get into that because, like, medical doctors don't usually have to wear a lab coat. Same thing with social scientists.
Right.
They don't actually need a lab coat. But, like, if they want to wear it. Yeah.
Like, I look the part.
Yeah. I don't get why people get so mad. I'm like,
funny.
They get to wear it if they want.
I love that this is, like, a thing. There's some disagreement here. Like, there's some animosity about the lab coat.
Yeah.
There's drama. I like it.
Oh, there's a lot of drama. There's, like, a whole thing of, like, chemists versus chemical engineers. A feud.
I love it. I got you off topic.
That's
me.
That's okay. We're gonna get back to it. Yeah. Again, we have not solved how to actually detect carbon-14 in regular samples.
Right.
And so they want to decrease the background noise. That background noise is, again, from the atmosphere, from regular radioisotopes that are naturally occurring all the time. Some of the common ones if people are going to get exposed to a radioisotope, of course, potassium, like I was saying, potassium, you know, in bananas and all that kind of stuff. But the other really common one is radon. So radon 222, it builds up in basements. So if you have a basement, you really should get tested for radon. I think most people who have basements know that, but
In
case.
I'm calling my mom immediately after this.
Yeah, you should really test your basements for radon.
Tornado season is coming. Check your radon levels.
The other things that would, like, increase your background in an area that you live is if you live near a natural uranium deposit. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know if that's... I think people know that. You, like, mine uranium out the ground.
Right.
So, like, if you live near one of those, or if you live near a nuclear facility of some type, so,
yeah,
like, a
I
nuclear
grew up
power
near
plant.
Pantex is where I grew up pretty close to there.
Yeah. I grew up pretty close to Oak Ridge.
Okay.
So, like, yeah, I'm sure I have a higher background radiation.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it just depends on where you live as far as that goes. But yeah, and if you live in one of these areas, you'd have more background that would interfere with a Geiger. And so if you had a Geiger counter from the 1940s, you're only going to get the background. Like, to detect above that background is harder.
Right.
To eliminate as much background as they could, Libby created what was called an anti-coincidence counter, which basically was multiple of the Geiger counters surrounding a sample, and then the sample and the Geiger counters were in a shield with thick metal sides to block the external radiation.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense.
So, yeah, kind of, I don't know what metal it was, but, you know, just a big, thick metal box around it to block everything else.
Creative.
Yeah, and then, again, multiple Geigers. So, of course, with a radiation sample, why multiple Geigers helps is that with a radiation sample, it's not going in one direction. So it's not, like, all the radiation is going in one direction. So if you had a sample, it's going from all directions out of the sample. And so if you had multiple Geigers to surround your sample, you're more likely to catch all the incidents of radiation.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So.
Like, kind of the way sound bounces a little bit, kind of?
So, it's... Because the thing is sound is still directional to a certain degree.
True, right.
You know what I mean? This really does... It goes in any direction from the sample.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So Libby and James Arnold proceed to test that radiocarbon dating theory by analyzing samples with known ages. How they had known ages was that, you know, I was talking about the layers of dirt.
Oh, okay. So they used other ways to be like, I know exactly how old this sample is because they can verify it in a different way. Okay.
And so one of the first artifacts they used was from a museum. It was a piece of timber from an Egyptian pharaoh's Senusrit. The third's funeral boat.
Oh, cool.
So it was an object whose age was known by the records of its owner's death. So, like, they even have a record of when this person died. These results were published in Science, the journal Science, in December 1949. So some call this the moment of what they call the radiocarbon revolution. As it was within 11 years of this announcement, more than 20 radiocarbon dating laboratories had been set up worldwide.
Yeah, no, that was my next question. Is like, I feel like if I made a discovery of that magnitude, like, my next step is I want to carbon date all the things in every museum.
Yes.
I want to know how old all the things are.
And that's exactly what happened.
That people are predictable. But that curiosity would just get the best of anybody. Like, there's so many things to test.
And that's one thing of, like, scientists, like, we cannot keep our mouths shut.
Oh, I
love like, if there's a big discovery, everyone is talking about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet it was a dead sprint to just get your hands on all the things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm sure there was a whole competitive about patents. Like, yeah. I don't know about I don't know if he patented it or, but that's often a thing, too, is, like, because, like, people get the whiff of, like, what's coming, right? Like, they're like, oh, I heard about radiocarbon dating. There had to be other people working on it. And so, like, it's sometimes, like, a race to who can patent it first.
Oh, that's such a dicey like, because there's so much money on the line.
Yeah.
And then it's weird because it's educational. So it's like, are we doing this for the money? And then it's like, yeah, kind of. But also science.
Yeah.
Also money.
So it's really an interesting thing because, like, some scientists, too, are, like, they don't want to patent their work.
Right.
And then you get into a little bit of a beef, too, because, like, the institution that you work for wants you to patent what you have made.
Right, because their name's on it, not just yours.
Because I think a lot of scientists are very much like, well, this knowledge is for anybody.
Right.
Whereas, like,
but it's
an like institution's like, but I fund you.
Right.
we need to fund more projects, and so we need the money from your project to fund more projects.
You used our stuff to make big discovery.
Right.
Got it.
So, like,
what a political game I had no idea was happening.
I mean, it's not that political. It's just kind of like, I think there are plenty of scientists out there who would rather the knowledge be out there for free.
Right.
But they just have to recognize that they also need money to do their work.
Yeah.
So.
Somebody's got to pay you.
Yeah. But yeah. And then in 1960, Libby was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for radiochemistry. Or for radiocarbon dating.
So, like, how long is it, like, we discover that we can, we can isolate this part, I guess, I don't know the words. We can identify carbon-14 between, like, we can identify it versus, like, we can do carbon dating.
So, it looks like we could do carbon dating. It was in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I'm going to say, 1945 is when Willard started the project, or when Willard Libby started the project.
That's so much faster than I think I thought it was going to be when we started. I was thinking this is going to be, like, a several years, you know, decades long kind of getting it right. But it seems like once they got it right, they got it right.
Well, so part of it, too, is, like, there are other things going on in the background as far as, like, there was the... Because how far back do you want to go? The discovery of radiation? Do you want to go back to...
Right.
You know, like, so there's... It is longer for the sake of this particular story, there's a part where you have to cut it off.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But, like, there was stuff before that of, like, just the discovery of isotopes, the discovery of radiation, the discovery of different kinds of radiation.
Everybody's so, stair-stepping.
Yeah. That so, like, sense. There is a lot more to this story that you could go into.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, before Libby's research, investigators in, you know, archaeology and geology had to rely on methods of dating that were relative. You were just comparing layers on a site, layers of dirt in which the artifacts were found. You could say that this thing was older than this thing because it was above it in the dirt.
Right, but there was no way to test ages on things that were already... If they didn't keep records on, like, an archaeological dig, you have no idea now.
Right.
Got it.
And so that's another thing, like, if you ever discover something, like, out and about, you find an arrowhead or something,
right.
If you actually want it to be of scientific value, you have to leave it where it was.
Huh.
Because then...
Right.
And people could know where it was in the dirt and, like, know that kind of stuff. So that's why they say to leave that stuff where it is.
Interesting.
Like, if you're just going to take things.
Yeah, no one's ever paid attention. I live where there's, like, lots of arrowheads. And immediately when you said that, I was like, I know several people who were just like, look at this cool thing I found. And
yeah.
I have not thought about the scientific value of it for a second. But it's also, like, commonplace enough that it's, like, I could probably name 5 people off the top of my head who have found them on their ranch land.
Oh, yeah.
Wild.
Yeah, so, but yeah, this is all just, like, relative dating measures, so you couldn't say, oh, this is 5,000 years old.
Right.
By contrast, radiocarbon dating obviously can provide, it's providing the first objective method, the ability to give, like, actual numbers to things. And so, this method has helped to disprove several previously held beliefs, including the notion that civilization originated in Europe and diffused throughout the world. By dating manufactured artifacts from Europe and North and South America, Asia, Africa, Australia, island nations, you can see that, like, civilizations developed independently across multiple sites around the world.
Right.
And so, like, by civilization, I mean, like, cities and
right.
settlements, you know.
Communities.
Communities. And so, archaeologists were able to ask more searching questions about, like, the evolution of human behavior in prehistoric times.
Right.
Because, like, a lot of time was spent, like, oh, well, how old is this? Like, is it relative to this thing? When did this civilization actually exist?
Oh, so,
like,
you can kind of put tools in people's hands a little bit.
Yeah, and so now it's like, well, what did they use this tool for? Like, they can go to different questions.
Right. That's cool.
Yeah. Libby's work helped contribute to geology, and, like, by using wood samples from trees once buried under glacial ice, Libby was able to prove that the last ice sheet in North America receded 10,000 to 12,000 years ago. So, like, there was trees in this ice block. He carbon dated the trees, and they were able to say, well, these were 10,000 to 12,000 years old.
Wow.
And previously, geologists had estimated that was 25,000 years ago. You can actually have concrete numbers to things now.
Right. Those implications are big for, like, how do we live our lives now, because you can kind of work backwards. You can estimate based on our own conditions now. Like, how did that happen faster than we thought it did?
Oh, yeah.
This feels like an answer that, like, birthed 1,000 more questions.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and then we'll get into, like, towards the end of this about, like, all the questions that get, now that we know that people were in the Americas this much earlier, that's a whole other breadth of questions.
Right.
So, yeah. And so, when Libby first presented radiocarbon dating to the public, he estimated that the method may have been able to measure ages up to about 20,000 years. So, which, already gigantic. And then, with subsequent advances in the technology, they're now able to reliably date materials as old as 50,000 years. In the early days of the technique, it was understood that it was dependent on the atmospheric carbon-14 to carbon-12 ratio remaining the same over a period of thousands of years, right? Because we're talking large timescales. At first, they just kind of assumed that that was always the same. That's not really quite true. So
nice.
to verify, you know, they're testing objects that were of datable age. The results were, you know, a lot of the things they were testing gave reasonable agreement to the ages that were estimated before.
Right.
But over time, there became discrepancies, especially for known objects from, like, old Egyptian dynasties because we had written records.
Right,
so
I was just thinking that, though, but, like, how, like, the unit of, we measured time differently.
Yes, but, like, there's enough data between Egypt and ancient Greece and ancient Rome that you can, like,
kind of estimate
you can,
how they were measuring time.
Exactly.
Okay.
You know, most of our modern ideas of time come from the Romans, and the Romans did exist concurrently with the Egyptians, so, like, we can
oh,
track
you can kind
that.
Of cross-reference here. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
There were things, though, that were, like, not lining up. Right, and so they knew that they were making assumptions as far as the carbon-14, carbon-12 ratio, and so they had to figure out a way to make this more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did was they started studying tree rings.
Oh, okay.
Because, like,
right.
you know, tree ring,
the
you
age.
Can count the rings
yes.
and get the age, but the other thing is those grow within 1 year. So you can test each little tree ring
right.
and figure out the carbon-14, carbon-12 ratio
oh.
in that tree ring. And then,
smart.
Because especially if you freshly chop down the tree, you know when it died.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Right? So you can
That's
track
so
that
smart.
All the way back.
That's so smart.
And this is possible with kind of any annual plant, by the way. So
right.
you can do this with corn and get that carbon-14, carbon-12 ratio for the year that it grew.
That's fascinating. I think it's cool that it wasn't like a wild solution, like it was a solution they had at hand, like everywhere. That's cool.
Each ring preserves a record of the amount of atmospheric carbon-14 to carbon-12 in the year it grew, and carbon dating the wood from the tree rings themselves provides the check on the other stuff that we are dating.
Mm-hmm.
Right, if you have a sample with a known age and then you have your measurements, and they basically make this thing called a calibration curve, and so you can test everything. And you could do this they did this regionally as well, so like different regions around the world will have different amounts of carbon-14 to carbon-12.
Oh yeah.
You know, they've made all kinds of calibration curves to account for all the various ratios that exist throughout time and space. Space meaning earth space, not
so
like space,
space
space
space earth space.
Basically, using these tree rings, they now have a continuous sequence of tree rings that span 13,900 years. And so in the 1960s, Hans Suess was able to use the tree ring sequence to basically correct the dates on those Egyptian samples that were off
right.
and show, like, yep, these are the new dates, and they are consistent, and everything is good.
Wow. That's insane. That kind of, like, it's not rewriting history, but it's, like, it kind of rewrites history, but it's, like,
correcting. I would say it reframes it.
I like that. Reframing makes sense.
Yeah.
Putting it in a way that we can understand it now. There's a timeline that works and that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
The other thing, let's go back into, yeah. So, obviously, like, as I'm going over this, carbon is, like, the most useful for biological samples. But we have actually learned to, I shouldn't say carbon date, but radio date with other elements as well. So we have helium-3, beryllium-10, neon-21, aluminum-26, and chlorine-36.
Okay, I'm going to ask like a very entry-level like question.
Mm-hmm.
So are any of those able to date not organic material? Like, are they?
Yeah, so these are, that's what I'm saying. Like, these
okay.
are for not biological samples.
Got it.
So,
okay,
like,
cool.
you can actually
so
date a rock
date
with some of
pottery.
These things. Yes.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. And, like, literally a rock.
That's crazy. That's so cool.
The biggest source of error for biological samples is when newer material is introduced to it.
Uh-huh.
So if you have a small amount of carbonaceous material, so, say, skin cells, something like that, if you add your skin cells into an older sample, you're contaminating it.
Right.
And you'll see a sample will seem younger than it is. So you have to have multiple measurements and preferably multiple samples
right.
to date things. And my understanding is water can also, any amount of water exposure can also
right.
alter things.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I've been alluding to this whole episode.
I'm so excited.
There's a recent discovery that, again, has made people very excited because people have been in the Americas a lot longer than we thought. They've actually been able to radiocarbon date a set of footprints that are in southern New Mexico. So
okay.
you might be thinking, how do I radiocarbon data footprint? We'll get into that.
Yes,
but,
several questions.
So these footprints are actually protected, so you can't, like, go find them.
Right.
And they're in the White Sands National Park. Basically, the tracks belong to several dozen individuals. Most people say that they're mostly, like, teenagers and children
mm-hmm.
by the size of the footprint.
Right.
But there's some debate about that because, like, maybe the people were of a smaller stature.
Right.
You know, like...
We do have evidence of, like, statures of people changing throughout history, right?
Exactly.
Right.
So, like, you know, based on modern humans, the size of the feet would be small. And, like, children in teenage size.
Huh.
But yeah, so, but these could have been fully grown adults and they just had smaller feet. You know, it's not super,
that's not super.
you can't really say.
So I'm like I buy children's shoes all the time because they're cheaper. So I'm like, maybe they're just like, they have tiny feet like me.
I also have tiny feet.
Yeah. I'm like, that doesn't hold up. People have tiny feet.
The footprints have seeds in them from a species called spiral ditch grass, which is an aquatic plant. These are, like, embedded in the footprints. And so, based on geological data, the footprints were dated between 20,000 and 22,000 years old.
Uh-huh.
And that's based on geology.
Right.
However, that predates the estimates of human arrival in the Americas by 10,000 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah. The dating of this type of geological record is really difficult because of, like, from my understanding, it was, like, the nature of the dirt,
uh-huh.
and, like, I guess this is, like, kind of a wetland. The dirt is very soft, and so, like, it's
right.
just not super concrete evidence as far as how old these footprints were. But, like,
right.
geologically, we're, like, the geologists were, like, I'm pretty sure this is between 20,000 and 22,000 years old. But, of course, people were, like, oh, I don't think that's strong enough evidence
right.
to confirm that, especially considering that's 10,000 years earlier than they should be.
Right. that's not give or take 40 years.
Right, exactly. Of course, researchers turned to radiocarbon dating the seeds that were found in the footprints.
And they were aquatic plants, you said? Okay.
Yeah, they were aquatic plants.
Yeah.
One person described it as the holy grail of trying to date footprints.
Jeez.
And another person said, I think this is the biggest discovery about the peopling of America in 100 years.
That's fascinating.
I don't know what gods they prayed to, but this is a dream find. That's all the quote. That's the whole quote.
I love that. Where was that quote? Like, I want that to be in the most prestigious science journal of all time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm pretty sure I found that quote in CNEN, which
yes.
is a chemistry magazine.
I love it.
That's
the kind of, I might pick up a chemistry magazine now. That makes me want to pick that up. That's the kind of quotes we're getting out of it. Like, count me in.
Once they dated the seeds, they collaborated with geological estimates. They found the seeds to be 21,000 to 23,000 years old. And so this is the oldest estimate on record that has been agreed upon by most scientists in the field. Most people are like, yeah, it's very hard to argue with this data.
Wow.
The location of the footprints, too, is in southern New Mexico, which indicates that humans had to be in the Americas for longer than 20,000 years, considering that the humans had to travel inland to that location.
Right, that's not in a... That's wild.
Right, it's not a coast at all.
No,
you know?
We're traveling, and that's not an... That's a pretty substantial ways to go from a coastline.
Exactly, and, like, what are the odds that that's the first humans to walk in that area, right?
Yeah, that seems, like, pretty low, like...
Really low.
Low odds.
Wow. Yeah, and like I was saying earlier, the biggest source of error in this case would have been contamination from water, right? So there's water nearby, and especially if the thing in water is calcium carbonate. So calcium carbonate would be the carbon contaminant,
uh-huh.
and that would contaminate the seeds over time.
Right.
The researchers say such they call them reservoir effects are unlikely because they dated hundreds of these seeds in different sediment layers. And basically, in the sediment layers, they were falling into line. So the older seeds are on the bottom and the younger ones on top.
Wow.
So if they had incorporated carbon through the water, you would see variation, right? So
right,
they wouldn't be consistent.
Not, But that's crazy, because it's almost like they tried to prove themselves wrong. Like, it's almost so unbelievable that they were like, this can't be right, let's prove it incorrect, and then couldn't do it.
Exactly.
Wow.
Like, they were very rigorous in their testing.
That's insane.
Of course, previous estimates were 11,000 to 13,000 years ago, and that was based on tools found in the Americas. And so those tools were created by a culture that we have named, obviously we don't know what they named themselves,
right.
But we named it the Clovis culture. That was the culture of people that came from Siberia into Alaska via the land bridge. However, there have been theories before that humans migrated across the ice during the Ice Age. And there have been some studies that date stone tools as early as 30,000 years ago. But again, there's a debate as to whether those stone tools were made by humans or just neat-shaped rocks.
Right, naturally, yeah.
Especially as you get to the older tools that are not, like, clearly an arrowhead or clearly an object that has clearly been a, you know, because, like, the early tools, of course, are not, like, they're just a nice-shaped rock.
Right, well, that's even, like, what do you classify as tool? Like,
exactly.
I can use any rock to open a type of fruit.
Right, and I mean, that
special,
is a tool.
Special rock to do that, but then it's like, how do you determine, like, special and non-special rock tool?
Exactly, yeah, especially once you're in, like, Stone Age territory,
I'm
it's like, is this a tool, or is this just a nice rock that I like?
I love that debate so much. That really adds validity to my whole, like, look at my cool rock childhood. Love that.
Oh, yeah.
These are tools, family.
It's a tool. This is kind of off topic again, but, like, so I do a lot of x-ray crystallography in my work, too.
Uh-huh.
And so I grow crystals.
Oh,
and
cool.
So people have asked me before if I'm, like, a crystal girl, like, as far as, like, because there are people that use crystals for religious reasons or, you know, energy reasons.
Yeah.
And, I'll be honest, I don't fully understand.
No.
That realm, but I do like the implication that I am a crystal girl in the same way that they are crystal.
Love that. You are like bridging gaps between all kinds of humanity. You could be like you're like doing like black magic to these people a little bit, and I like that. Like you're creating.
Yeah, like the idea that that's the thing that I love, right? Is it like,
I'm
doing is magic.
It feels like like you're like sitting in a lab and you're like, I can create, like, a love crystal, and I love the idea that, like, that could be a thing. That's marketable, Dylan. You could be making some big bucks. I don't know if you've thought about that, but you're sitting on $1 billion.
Maybe.
It's science. You could sell it as science. I like that.
Yeah.
Don't sell that science. There's
some things I tell people, too, because I do know a lot about crystals, and there's, like, one particular crystal that, like, because I guess people will put the crystals in water and then, like, have, like, moonlight shine on them.
I love it.
To absorb moon energy.
Good.
Again, this is my rough understanding.
Yes.
And some of the crystals are water-soluble.
Oh.
And some of them are poisonous.
Not ideal.
So, some people who don't know... and I do believe some people drink the water afterwards, and I'm like, please don't drink your crystal water.
Oh.
A lot of crystals are leaching things into your water that you do not want to drink.
That's how I
want
to go. That's how I'm being called home, folks. I'm here to hear first. Wild. Love
so,
that.
Just, if you are doing magic with crystals, please ensure that your crystals are not water soluble.
Do not drink the crystal water. This has been... What are those called? The messages. Like, thank you for coming to
the
my
more
TED
you
talk.
Know.
The more you know.
The
thank
more
you
know.
I love that. You're going to put that on PBS.
And then, so, there's also been some really interesting discussions occurring because of genetic evidence. So this is a little off topic of, like, radiocarbon dating. It kind of adds to the evidence of, like, people being here before we thought that they were here, and also kind of starts to explain some mysteries that we've had as far as genetic evidence of people that have been in the Americas for, you know, generations, thousands of years. At least the Native Americans that are in North America, that most of them have Asian ancestors that came about 15,000 to 16,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That leads all kinds of questions of, like, does that mean there are multiple waves of migration? Did the original occupants get replaced by the Clovis culture when they came across the land bridge?
Huh.
Because And then part of the problem, too, is because of colonization from Europeans and their introduction of disease, a lot of the genetic heritage of Native American populations have been lost.
Right, they're just wiped out.
Yeah, so the estimate is that post-colonialization, 80% of the population of the Americas died.
Golly, that's staggeringly
high. And so if there were more studies tracking the genome of pre-colonial populations, you would definitely see a lot more diversity. Right. And so, like, there's essentially an erasure of their genetic history.
That's insane. I've never thought about that, but I never knew that number was that high.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it comes from disease. Yeah. Because Europeans had a lot of diseases that Native Americans had no immunity to.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no immunity to it at all. Golly, that sweeps through I never knew the number was that high at all.
Mm-hmm. If there comes a time where we are just studying pre-colonial populations, we could maybe start establishing if there are waves of migration, approximate timelines of arrival, that kind of thing. Some of the older DNA sequenced comes from South America. And one thing that's interesting is it shows similarities to modern day Aboriginal Australian populations.
Huh. These are not any way, like, they're not geographically close to each other, even a little.
Yeah.
That's halfway around the planet. That's crazy.
So what it is there's a specific genetic marker common among indigenous Australian populations called the Y signal. And the first study to find the Y signal in South America was done in 2015. They tested 200 individuals from the Caratiana and the Suri groups. They were genetically sequenced. So, however, these were like modern individuals, right? So this wasn't,
right,
you know, pre-colonial or anything. Uh-huh. So a lot of people were like, well, it's possible that there was modern travel between Australia and South America.
Right.
So it's not really proof of ancient migrations, but it was a first clue of, like,
it's a possibility.
It's a possibility.
Or we should at least look more in this direction.
Exactly. Because, like, especially, you know, I mean, 200 individuals is, like, relatively a small sample size. I mean, it's not terribly tiny, but especially they're from two groups, relatively small groups, you know. So it's possible that there's just been a few individuals that came over in a more modern sense.
Right.
Modern being, you know, like, because we're talking 20,000 years, right? Yeah. So, like, anything time within the past 2,000 years would be considered modern.
That's still wild to me. That's crazy.
And so last year, there was a geneticist who worked at the University of Sao Paulo, Tabita Huenmeyer, published results. They did a study of 383 modern humans living throughout South America, including in the Brazilian Amazon and the Central Plateau. So it's a much broader geographic area than the first study. And they worked with the indigenous communities. And so they found the Y signal in groups living outside the Amazon. So the first groups were in the Amazon. They're now seeing this in a broader range of people. Particularly, they saw it in the Zavante, who live on the Brazilian plateau in the country's center, so in the center of the country.
Right.
And in Peru's Chotuna people, who descended from the Mojica civilization that occupied the country's coast from about 100 CE to 800 CE. Definitely showing that this Y signal is dispersed throughout the continent. It's not just
one geographic location.
One geographic location. Because
that can be like a fluke, but like that's too big of a geographic area to be like, nah.
Yeah, and so now you have, like, you know, this is 383 people plus the 200 from before.
Right.
We're now seeing 500 individuals over a large geographic area, all showing the same Y signal that was previously thought to be unique to an Aboriginal Australian population.
That's fascinating to me.
Yeah. Through this study, the scenario that they found that fit the best was that the ancestors carried this marker from Australia to South America had to be between 15,000 and 8,000 years ago.
That's still an insane amount of time.
Yeah.
It's really hard to apply, like, that modern, like, what is modern time and how did we travel in a modern sense? Because that doesn't feel modern to me.
Well, I mean, that's not modern.
Yeah. I was like, it's wild to think, like, what does travel look like from that? That's a big variation of it's a lot of planet to traverse.
Oh yeah,
8,000 years ago.
And they've done the models, and so they've shown that the migrants likely followed a coastal route. They arrived on the coast,
right,
and then spread across the coast, and then they would split off into groups into the central plateau, and then the Amazon.
Wild.
So like they
that
even like kind of track it.
That's crazy that they can even do that,
mm-hmm,
to me. That's that makes sense.
And I mean, again, this is just the scenario that they found fit their data best.
Right.
So it's not necessarily the truth,
but definitely.
But,
like,
but this is
the
first step. Yeah.
That every time that you tell me something new, I'm like, that poses so many more questions. Like, it's just, it's a never-ending chase the next answer. It never stops. And I think that's really cool.
Absolutely.
It ensures your job security.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think we've gotten sufficiently off the topic of radiocarbon dating, but I just also thought it was really cool to see how different fields can contribute information to the same question.
Well, because everything holds hands. Like, it's nice to know that the scientific community kind of needs each other to validate their own efforts,
mm-hmm,
and here's my piece of the pie, and here's your piece of the pie, and here's why I need this.
Yeah.
That's nice. Well,
and I think it's also
a mistake. Like, it proves your data.
Right.
But they're not biased in any way. Like, they're not trying to prove your thing.
Yeah. Like, I mean, there's no reason why this genetic data should match the other data.
Right.
And that kind of, those kind of thoughts, you know.
It's a nice check and balance.
It's a check and balance. And, yeah, and I think it's a peek into, like, how science works, which is another, like, goal I have of my podcast,
mm-hmm,
is to show you, like, how over time people are adding information into the same question. And
right,
people are, you know, there's not really a eureka moment. Very rarely is there, like, a eureka moment of,
right,
like, oh, here you go.
Well, a lot of it's, like, accidental. Like, we accidentally,
mm-hmm,
figured out this piece of your pie, so here you go.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And I just thought it was an interesting thing that has really reframed our idea of human migration and how, you know, like, again, when I was a kid, I'm sure when you were a kid and when anybody listening to this podcast was a kid, you know, you're learning that humans migrated through the Bering Strait from Siberia into Alaska. But, I mean, it's becoming increasingly clear that there were multiple migrations over thousands of years into the Americas, and that is all contributing into the genetic lineages of indigenous people that live here.
It's just, it's crazy to think how much change there is in, like, a short amount of time. Like,
mm-hmm,
in our lifetime that's been discovered, and in the, I mean, I wonder, like, I teach high school kids, like, what will their kids be taught in high school?
Oh, yeah.
Because we'll have so much more information.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a totally different educational landscape. And
absolutely,
how cool is that? Love that.
And doing some of these podcasts, like, it really shows, like what I've learned is not the same thing as what my oldest professors learned.
Right.
You know, like, they learned older models of things and then had to relearn it.
Yeah.
Like, even, like, the way we name chemicals changed from the time that my professors were in school to now.
Right.
Like, how we name things.
That's, like, a steep learning curve, too. That's, and the dedication to keep changing what you know,
mm-hmm,
and the open-mindedness that that must take.
Oh, yeah.
You're being proven wrong all the time.
All the time. Constantly.
That's a big burden. People don't like to be proven wrong.
Oh,
but,
no.
Like, that's this career path.
Yeah.
Dang.
And that's what I find it very liberating, though, personally.
Yeah.
And that's one thing, because, like, I just recently went through my, we call it a research exam.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's a candidacy exam for,
right,
me to be a PhD candidate.
Right.
And people were like, oh, you're so nervous. You gotta be nervous. They gotta be drilling you on, like, everything you need to know and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, well, they are, because they're trying to determine that I know enough chemistry to continue to be a chemist.
Right.
Right. But the other thing they're really testing you is if you're willing to say that you don't know something. Because they do not want you to pull information out of your butt and say that it's,
right,
fact. They do not want you to do that.
That's a liability of a candidate.
Yeah.
Whew.
So, like, that's part of what they're testing. So if you don't know something, your answer should be,
I don't know.
This is how I'll find out.
Right. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
We should take that to school immediately.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would have a lot less stress,
yeah,
if that could be their answer.
Maybe
to things.
Maybe they wouldn't have dropped out of non-major chemistry on the first day of class.
Yeah, because there's even people talking about, like, how to structure chemistry classes, because mm-hmm. like me as a professional chemist, I always have resources, right? I can always Google something, I can always look it up in a book. And so it doesn't really make sense to have closed note exams.
Yeah.
I'm not saying give kids access to the internet.
I agree with you, though. That's the tools that we have at our disposal. And so it's weird to test kids no matter what level they're on, whether it be it they're, you know, master's students or they're in the sixth grade.
Right.
It's very strange to test people in an environment that is not true to the universe that we live in.
Right.
Because, like, it really is no longer about what do you know. It's about how resourceful are you? Can you figure it out?
Can you figure it out? Absolutely. Because some of the best classes I've had have had open-ended exams mm-hmm. where you take it home and you have to do it and figure it out.
Well,
because you can't Google the answer.
Yeah. Well, because then I don't want to know what you can memorize and regurgitate.
Yeah.
Because that's what we did mm-hmm. when that was our life as students.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm like, you know, I do know that I had a lot of science education and history education that I learned for exactly 6 weeks.
Oh yeah, and then you flush it.
Uh-huh, because I don't need
it
anymore. Like, it's taking up space and now I need to clear that space for something else. But like, that's such a loss for people that want to stick to that, like, this is education
mm-hmm.
system, because that's not education. Like, education should be like, let's ask all the questions.
Yeah.
And see if we can figure out the answer. And if no one has the answer, then, like, that seems like a good opportunity for science education to be like, we can figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
It may be take decades.
And that's how science works, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is literally how we've been doing it. Like,
yeah.
we asked a question and we figured out the answer. Like,
that's a cycle. And then we had several more questions and figured it out. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's how science works. So why are we training people to just memorize things when that's not how they're going to actually solve their problems?
No one does anything like that.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything. There's been several times, if you're my student, I'm so sorry. There's been several times where it's like, I need a list of adjectives right now because I don't actually know all the adjectives.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
no reason for my brain to do that.
I mean, that's why a thesaurus exists.
Yeah. Like, you just... the internet is a beautiful tool. Like,
mm-hmm.
use your tools. Okay, sorry, I just, like, tangent.
It's all good. So that's all I had for this episode. What do you think of radiocarbon dating in the episode and being on my podcast?
Things. It had a lot more implications than I thought it was going to, or that I knew of. Because I think I had an idea of, like, and now we can know how old stuff is. And then I kind of thought, like, and that's where that stopped. And that's where it was, that's the beginning of 17,000 more questions. It's
yeah.
not like, now we know how old it is, like, good job us. It's what does that mean for history? Or, like, what do
mm-hmm.
we know about the universe? How did we get here? And that it's so much more in depth than I thought it was going to be.
Oh, yeah. And that's the nature of science. Like, you solve one thing.
Right.
10 more questions.
I think there's real life implications for the stuff that people come up with in labs and figure out
mm-hmm.
that I hadn't really considered. It's nice to also, like, hear about the real people that figured this out.
Right.
Because I kind of love the idea that, like, these people in the 40s, like, went home and then they were so exhausted and they picked themselves a drink and, like, pondered the universe a little bit. I'm like, that's crazy. Like, they're, like, regular people who had a question and chased down an answer.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it a lot more accessible. Like, these are real people.
Oh yeah,
and you're real people. That's cool.
And the other thing too, I think is really cool is showing how like you said, they're real people, and like some of them are really mean,
yeah.
but some of them are cool, and like
right.
This
wasn't
and
their whole
interest
life.
Outside of things,
yeah.
you know, like. Yeah, because I do think that's interesting of...
We don't think about people like that. Like,
mm-hmm.
Dylan the chemist, Dylan the comedian, Dylan the person who goes home to their family.
Right.
Like, we're not one thing, and it's neat to think about people in that context. It makes them feel more approachable, and it makes this whole thing feel a lot more accessible.
Absolutely, because there's that whole idea of scientists are, like, these brilliant, crazy people who, like, spend their entire time
I want to know about all
in
the
a
scientist
lab.
Dogs. That's what I want to know. Like, do you have a dog? Like, do you fight with your spouse? Like, that's what I want to know about these people.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, they're just, like, regular.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and if you, people are people.
Yeah, at the end of the day, like, we're all just kind of doing the best we can. This was
scientists
so
are just, like, super into one thing. That's why. Yeah. They're just, like, all super into a thing.
This was really fun. I have to admit, I was a little nervous because my science knowledge is so... I think I discount myself, and I'm like, no, it's zero. But I'm like, no, you knew kind of where we were going.
Yeah.
And that makes it feel like, because I'm very much of the mind, if I can figure out where it's going, like, anybody can figure out where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you made it feel very approachable and not scary, and I could be like, what is a Geiger, and what is a half-life? Lots of questions that
yes.
you're like... But then I was like, oh, okay, got an explanation, and now I'm, like, paying attention, and I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But it made it not scary to ask questions. Thank you for not being scary to ask questions, too.
Thank you. I really try hard not to be scary.
No, that's so nice. I think as an educator in the other kind of, the pre-get to Dylan class, I think there's people that, like, pride themselves on being scary educators,
yes.
and it makes me really sad. Because mm-hmm. it should be accessible, and it should be, like, no one should ever be punished for I don't know.
Absolutely. And, like, the other thing I find, too, like, I had a professor that was very much an intimidating professor, mm-hmm. and I chose to put that guy on my master's thesis committee,
right?
And everyone was like, oh, my God, you put him on your master's thesis committee? You know, he's so scary, he's so mean, he's going to drill you, and, you know, and I'm like... I saw that man in a NASCAR shirt at Walmart hanging out with his daughter.
Right.
He's not scary.
He's just another guy,
you know?
And
the other thing is, like, he's not asking me questions to be mean.
He's asking to make my research better.
Exactly. And that's the other thing is, like, I think some people... Because scientists have really bad social skills.
Uh-huh.
That is a fact. Chemists, physicists, we are bad at communicating with the general public. That is just a fact of life.
I love it.
And so just to, like, remember, like, these guys are not these crazy, brilliant, mad scientists.
Right.
They like NASCAR. They have children.
They're nervous about talking to people. Who's not?
Yes. Very nervous.
We're all nervous.
And, like, they're probably spouting off a bunch of facts and big words because they're nervous.
Yeah, well, everybody goes to what they know when they're nervous.
Exactly.
Everybody talks about what they're comfortable with when they're in a nervous social situation. That's just what they're, like, that's their real housewives. Let them know they're real housewives.
Exactly. Like, some people go to football.
Yes.
I go to chemistry because that's what I know.
I love it. I think you've done such a great job of making it accessible, not only here, but in your comedy as well. It's so much fun because I watch people kind of, like, catch on and then realize that they know what the joke is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun to watch people laugh and kind of, it's a weird pat on the back to be like, I understood that joke. I am smart. And, you know, sometimes you need that at 8 p.m.
Absolutely.
On Broadway Street. You need to know that you're not the dumbest person in the room.
One last fun fact. My goal in life is to be the dumbest person in any room.
I love that. If you're the smartest person in the room, find a new room.
Exactly.
I say that to my kids all the time. That's on a poster in my classroom.
Yeah. I live by it. So,
yes.
Like, you can show them this podcast and be like, look,
I'm
this
so
person
excited.
Getting a PhD follows this advice.
Yes. Fail better. That's exciting. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank
this was
you.
So fun.
And this will conclude our episode on radiocarbon dating. Thank you for listening to Cowboy Chemistry, and come back for our next episode in 2 weeks.
All right. Apoptosis going mad, my liver's gonna fail. Maybe it's from the radium I use to paint my nails. Well, say you hate me, carbon date me, throw me in the sea. I'll be back with time because I'm made of stardust and chemistry. Of stardust and chemistry.